Good morning, friends. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins. Lisa Smith was the founder of this august program, and we're produced by Kate Brister, who's been doing a remarkable job lately. Kate, thank you so much, Kate. And I'm happy to have in the studio with me today Patrick Corcoran, who is an Oregon State researcher and stationed locally and deals a lot with the various hazards that we face here on the North Coast.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Jim. Glad to be here.
So before we get started on the science and the geology, which you don't really want to talk about, and I do, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I came to Astoria in 2003 for a NOAA-funded coastal storms program.
That's right. Patrick and I used to be neighbors.
Yes. And so I'm an Oregon State University faculty. I've been on the faculty there since 1987, was in Corvallis for a number of years, came here in 2003 for the weather, the coastal storms program.
Yep.
In 2004, the Sumatra earthquake and tsunami happened. And that opened my eyes, and as a hazards outreach specialist, it seemed like something to focus on. And so since 2004, call it January of 2005, I've been wrapping my head around how we can best prepare for this earthquake and tsunami.
Right, and one of the things that we might want to take a quick look at is how do we know that we're facing another tsunami earthquake event? I mean, we know there's some in the past. What kind of science leads us to be pretty well assured that that's going to happen again?
I mean, that's a great question, because wouldn't it be nice if this was over and
yeah.
This wasn't going to happen again? Geologists have a saying that says what's happened can happen again. And the science on this really has been refined relatively late. You know, about 1990 was when the question of how can we have so many volcanoes and mountains but relatively few earthquakes can be addressed. And, you know, it took the decade of the 90s for the scientific consensus to kind of come to the place where, well, the subduction zone structure that we're on, like all of the other ones around the planet, you know, has these dramatic events on long-term intervals. Oh, goodness. And then finding out when the last one was very key. And it turned out the last one was in 1700. So we know the clock started in 1700. So we're 315, almost 316 years into the cycle. So what's happened in the past can happen again. The geology and the core samples and others have given us in recent years a real strong look at this repeated event.
Yeah, and these events, if I'm understanding correctly, are caused by the interaction between tectonic plates, one crunching up against the other. Is that...
Yeah, and another way to think of it, for the less geologically inclined, if you have nice wood floors and two Afghan rugs, and you're pushing them towards each other, the edges soon meet, and then they push, and one bumps up, and then it finally flaps over the other Afghan rug as they get pushed closer together. Very similar to our geologic situation.
Jim, can I interrupt a second?
Please do.
The story about how they know the last tsunami was in 1700 is very interesting for people who have never heard it. Can you give a short capsule of how they found that out?
I can, certainly. A geologist from the U.S. Geological Survey named Brian Atwater will go down in the Geologist Hall of Fame for noticing in his field work here on the coast, primarily up in Willapa Bay, these sunken forests, you know, these cedar forests that seem to have all died at the same time, and there's like this sort of dead forest in the lowland areas. You know, they thought about that, but then as the scientists working on a project, they come up with a consensus. It's like, what did you find? And he basically saw that, well, it would be consistent with a subduction zone earthquake and tsunami for the forest to drop a little bit, the salt water to come in and kill them all at once. And then the process of building up the muck happens for another few hundred years. They weren't sure what these sunken forests, but that was, and this is how science happens. Being a subduction zone earthquake would be consistent with what is seen. And so then you look a little bit deeper, and in this case, they did some research with Japanese who are used to earthquake, tsunami. Every once in a while, they get a tsunami without an earthquake, but they're pretty rare. What happened in 1700 was we generated a magnitude 9 earthquake that traveled across the ocean and hit Japan without any kind of warning. the opposite of what happened in 2011, where they had the earthquake and they sent the wave only over to us, and we experienced it. So by putting together the science of the Japanese, saying, hey, we had this big tsunami without an earthquake on this date, the Japanese were very literate and very accurate, and they had insurance. And so farmers had bags of rice on the docks in Japan, and the waves came up and damaged some of those bags of rice. And we know that through the insurance claims that the Japanese farmers made in 1700, you know, for the bags of rice. That also helped estimate how high up the water came, etc. So you put the Japanese experience and you get together with an American researcher who says, well, we have this thing here. And you go, gee, did your earthquake in the United States cause our tsunami in Japan? And that was another piece. And so these pieces start getting put together until a bigger picture is sort of formed. So the key piece that Brian discovered was that our sunken forests are the result of our land dropping during the earthquake in 1700 and the salt water coming in and killing those trees all at once. So that really, we do get those here. That really confirms, you know, no kidding. I look across the Young's Bay at the Lewis and Clark River, and some geologists were there, and I joined them, and they excised the riverbank. They just cut along the side of it and identified the last, not one, not two, not three, but four layers of ocean crystals and critters in layers of sand on the Lewis and Clark River. So, boom. So these things happen. Brian Atwater put the pieces together. Now when you dig deeper, you see that that's happened more than once.
Now, Patrick, these events are the result, if I understand correctly, because of the friction between the tectonic plates. They build up pressure, and all of a sudden, they break loose, and things start shaking. Is that...
That's good. Yep.
Is that too simple?
Kind of the Afghan rug analogy. Yeah, those two plates kind of push together, and something's got to give. And these are big...
But, you know, because of the increase in fracking and the drilling that's been done in the Midwest, we've become really adept at drilling down deep and doing stuff down there. And I couldn't help but wonder if we were able to locate the focus of the friction, the conflict in these two tectonic plates, would it be possible to drill down there and relieve that pressure in some way? I'm thinking like pumping a bunch of KY jelly down in there.
It's just gonna, okay.
What do you think?
Ever the contractor, Jim, looking for the technological solution to the problem. I think the... For things like fracking, those are very small structural kind of earthquakes. The subduction zone is the area that stuck is essentially from Vancouver Island to Mendocino.
Take a lot of KY.
It would take an awful lot of KY and a lot of drilling. So I think, no, I think what we're really faced with at this point in our technology, and this goes for early warning systems too, they're not going to give any early warning to people on the coast, but we're needing to... consider that the technological solutions are not going to address the problem at the level we need to. This is a behavioral problem. You know, we didn't know it until recently. So since Western settlement, we've come here and, you know, our story was we don't get big earthquakes. And that's why kind of some people even moved here for that. And so we have all of our valuable things in vulnerable places now, and now we're kind of learning retroactively that that wasn't a good idea.
Let's get away from the geology, Patrick, and talk about what do we do when it happens? Let's say we're sitting at home and, bam, the big earthquake happens. How should we be prepared? What can we do? How do we communicate?
The instructions are easy. Executing it might be challenging. I mean, the initial duck, cover, and hold during the earthquake. Don't let anything bonk you on the head. Your house, I know, is at high ground, so you need to have the discipline, the understanding, and the courage to stay there. And so you're in a good spot. Now, your wife has a business downtown, and so let's say she's at work and you're at home, and this is the reality that most people are really worried about is our family. We've got all our kids and spouses all over hither and yon. And if in the case of musical chairs, this happens with no warning, we're going to have people in different places and we're going to be worried about them. The most important thing about that is to have a conversation this evening about, what would you do? Well, what would you do? And just sort of talk through what you think you would do individually and just come to some agreement. You know, downtown in Astoria, we're kind of upriver from the ocean, so there'd be more time, but it's certainly a place you'd want to sort of get out of kind of eventually. The instruction might be for her to go home. I mean, that will be the impulse, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you don't know, maybe some injury occurred, and so you're nervous in one place and she's nervous in another. We have to expect that, and we have to think through what's the best thing. There is this urge to get together as quick as we can, But really the most important thing is to get together in one piece.
And safely.
And sometimes that might mean each individual's getting safe, staying there, overnight even, mm-hmm. and then finding our people the next day. That scenario is so much better than people running around like chickens with their head cut off and trying to drive over bridges and doing silly things. That same energy that allows a parent to pick up a car off a child also allows us to do silly things.
Now, assuming that everybody gets back home, the infrastructure is going to be kind of a wreck. What would you recommend a person do to be ready to survive for a while without truckloads of food coming down to Fred Meyer?
Good. Yeah, that's an important question. My focus professionally is like earthquake plus 24 hours because that's going to really be the critical time. But to answer your question, you know, what I do is have a go bag with me that I can have if I happen to be driving and maybe there's a landslide here and a landslide behind me and I find maybe I'm kind of stuck for a day.
A go bag, would you define that for me?
A go bag is a bag that I have and I keep it in my car that answers the question, what do I wish I had if I was stuck between two landslides on 101 for a day, overnight? And so when people ask me what's in your go bag, I really want to push back and say, look, you need to envision the scenario that you're going to be in and answer that question for yourself. I mean, mm-hmm. if you have children, that's a different consideration. I mean, I have the basics. I have rubber rain gear and boots and hat and gloves and a water purifier and a water bottle. And I got some other stuff too, flashlights, but that's all kind of little stuff. For me, the big thing is to keep my body warm and to have some shelter, you know, for a night out. That's all I have. I think I have a power bar in there. It's not that big of a deal for me to have gallons of water and pounds of food in my go bag. It has to be small enough to me to take it with me. So that's, and it's as much to me a prayer bead. The go bag is as much a meditation of remembering that this will happen and I have some, you know, resources at my disposal. Whether I have that with me at the actual moment, I don't know. But just the process of envisioning the scenario in which I would need a go bag helps me think of the reality that I'll be faced with.
The one thing that I've learned from you is situational awareness. Like, if you're at Fred Meyer, and it happens when you're at Fred Meyer, what do? Know where you can go to be safe, because you can't be safe at Fred Meyer. Approach situational awareness.
Yeah, I mean, now that, since I've kind of wrapped my head around this a lot, I can't help but look at those sort of safer and less safe places as I drive down the coast. And I know we have listeners in Tillamook and in Pacific County as well, and, you know, so that's important. I think of the map your lifestyle. I map my lifestyle. I think, okay, I work here, my house is here, you know, my recreation spot is here, my grocery store is here, and these are the roads that I take to get there. It's like, oh, that's kind of a big footprint in Clatsop County. But even then, it's not that hard to know where the high ground is there. If I'm in Tillamook and if I'm at the Fred Meyer in Warrenton and there's an earthquake, I'm going to go up to the box stores up on Home Depot and Costco area. If I'm in Tillamook and I'm at the Fred Meyer there, that's an interesting challenge. I mean, hopefully the bridge will be crossable to get to Juneau Hill to the north on 101. That's the closest up. Otherwise, you have to go south on 101 and make it sort towards the community college in Tillamook. If I'm shopping at Fred Meyer in Tillamook, those are my two options. I know that. In the situation, if I happen to be there shopping, I'll get out the front door and I'll look to the bridge. And if the bridge is there, I know that's my preferred way to go. I'll run over the bridge and go up Juneau Hill. If it's not, that means I have another choice to make. Just by thinking through that today will make, in the moment, an easier choice. Look left to the bridge. Oh, great. It's good. It wasn't very bad. Let's go. And then we're safe. Other places, you can do that with schools and other kind of things, too. That's a perverse game, I guess, I play. But I do think about, if it happened here, what would I do? And there's usually, what I find on the North Coast is there's just enough time to get to where you want to be if you know where that is before the earthquake happens. Too late during the quake to pull out your map or your app or something like that. But we're North Coast residents. You know, we know where, you know, we have a lot of geographic references to, you know, elk hunting and clamming and crabbing and all the nice places we like to go. Finding high ground is not that hard of a job. We just haven't had to do it before.
I'd like to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, and we're visiting with Patrick Corcoran. and we're talking apocalypses, one of my favorite languages, Patrick. Now, if I'm in downtown Seaside and I feel an earthquake, presumably caused by the subduction zone, which is 20 minutes away, really, that doesn't give you a lot of time to do something. So if I do happen to be in downtown Seaside, I feel the shaking. There's bridges all around me. How can I best figure out where to go?
By having thought about that before that happens. And if I were there, I would know that. I mean, Broadway Street is the direction that gets me up to Sunset Hills, if I'm at the promenade, for example. Unfortunately, Broadway Bridge isn't the beefiest bridge in the world, mm-hmm. and the First Street Bridge is actually the better bridge. And so knowing that, I would go to the convention center, cross the First Street Bridge, and come back down to Broadway and get to Sunset Heights, Sunset Hills. This is being aided by new maps that are coming out. Dogami, the city of Seaside, Tiffany Brown here at the Clatsop County.
These are being produced as we speak?
Correct. And they're using the Dogami data from the Department of Geology. So it's the same data layers, but maps are now being customized for local places. So, for example, in Seaside now, they're producing a map that shows travel times. So if you're at this intersection, you know, one, where do you need to go? Okay, fine. And how fast do you need to go to get there? So places that are closest to the beach, we call that would be a run speed will get you there in time. If you're a couple blocks inward, a jog speed will get you to the high ground in time. If you're relatively close, a walk speed. So these maps are using colors in other ways for people to get a sense of my relative risk in a various place, Seaside, Cannon Beach, Astoria, something like that. So the maps are becoming refined for use by people, showing us arrows, looking at, you know, the most direct route might be that way, but we now know there's a wetland over there or a bridge that won't be up, and we can start to refine the exit routes. As we do that, we can start telling the stories about that. Maybe we can paint the roads from the promenade to give you that little zigzag around the convention center back to Broadway. So the new maps are helping us refine our story about where we need to go, which is terrific.
Now, I know that you've got a cheat sheet in front of you, Patrick, and on that cheat sheet are some other subjects that maybe we'd like to talk about.
Absolutely. I mean, my big thing is for me and us to expect this thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, apparently there have been 40-plus of them in the last 10,000 years. They're going to keep happening. So once I expect it, then I viscerally change my sensibilities. And it's like, well, maybe I should put a go bag in the car. I mean, it took me to go to Japan in 2011 for me to get a go bag, Mr. Tsunami Guy. So I understand this isn't everybody's number one, two, three priority. But there are some opportunities. So expect it is the first thing. The second thing I think I want to talk about are the opportunities here. We've been talking for a decade about the challenges, and that's important to understand those. But we really have an opportunity here to figure out how people can live on a subduction zone in a resilient manner. I mean, we're not going anywhere. We're going to stay here. It will happen again. What can we do to make that less bad when it happens, and how can we bounce back better? So some of the opportunities I see for people, let's say you're a contractor in the North Coast. You know, there's a lot of people now interested in, geez, is my house, you know, bolted onto the foundation? There's things that contractors can do for structural improvements and not necessarily million-dollar redos, but maybe you just want in your house or institution the hallway that gets people out of the building reinforced for $10,000 or whatever the number is, right? We don't have to hit home runs. We can hit base hits. And contractors can then specialize in. Another real easy thing is your heating and air conditioning, your HVAC infrastructure in your house. Those are things that jiggle apart pretty easily, but there are also things that can be tightened up. So there are some low-hanging fruit. FEMA has a non-structural mitigation guide, you know, just these kinds of things. Say you're an interior designer, interior decorator. You've got somebody redoing their house, building the house. A lot of wonderful art in this community. Let's use closed hoop clips. So when you put the art on the wall, it won't jiggle off simply by coming off the hook. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Easy to do. Retailers can start selling these earthquake-proof art hanging devices and come up other things. Interior designers, what about the use of glass? You know, maybe there's an important place to have some shatterproof glass that maybe we didn't think about before. And so we can start adding value to what we're already doing by bringing this earthquake and tsunami savvy to our current things. Retailers, for example, I know down in Manzanita, the market down there is carrying the buckets and just the little stuff, the sawdust, the buckets that are used for sanitation. You know, we worry about the water after this event, but the other part is important too. So now the market carries the buckets that people know to use to have in their rental unit or in their home. So that retailer's making money by selling the proper buckets. Not too hard. They're not going to make $1 million doing it. But over time, we can start to, we need to own it, frame it, and capitalize on it. Hmm. Own the fact that we live on a subduction zone. Frame it in a way that we prefer. I think it's great, like living on the edge, you know? And then capitalize on it. I mean, we live here, we might as well, I mean, make some money on it, not in a greedy, bad way, but in a, we need to do this, let's provide some financial incentives for doing the right thing. So the opportunities for contractors, interior designers, retailers, they're out there. We need to start looking a little bit at the upside and what we can do proactively and positively to live here, to thrive here. There are millions of people that live on subduction zones around the world. They knew they lived on them in Chile and Japan, for example. We kind of just figured it out. We're smart enough to get it together in time.
Go ahead.
I invite people to just think of that range of opportunities that are out there. So expecting it, looking for some opportunities, communicating with our families. Now, we talk about family plan. That sounds like a three-ring binder to me. A family agreement, family understandings amongst family members, and kind of just bring people along. So there we go. So we have some opportunities. We have the situation. We have some opportunities there, and we can start to exploit them. Some paper here coming. We got some news coming in. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure what's going on, but okay.
Line 2 has a question if you want to take it.
We're not really set up to take questions over the telephone, but if somebody would write the question down, we could certainly ask Patrick.
Absolutely. Love to do that.
Yeah. Now, Patrick, part of your job as a kind of an outreach coordinator for Oregon State is to go around the subduction zone, the North Coast, and kind of promulgate this message. Is that pretty much what you do?
It is, and it's getting a whole lot easier because people, agencies, institutions, individuals are starting to pick up. I mean, the 100th monkey has occurred. I mean, people kind of get it. I can move on from talking about geology to opportunities, and people are doing things. You know, hospitals and schools are evacuating. The maps are being refined. There's more talk about siting public facilities in better or worse places, and it seems like little sprouts everywhere. CERT programs are popping up. Teen CERT programs are popping up. So there is becoming a threshold across the board of not only interest but, you know, taking steps to be more prepared, which is really exciting to see.
Now, one of the things that we know happens during an earthquake is the liquefaction. And, you know, Astoria is built on fill. Warrenton is built on sand. It seems to me that when and if this, when it occurs, we're going to have a lot of liquefaction. Buildings are going to start sinking. And if that's the case, it's going to be really difficult for people to get anywhere. So if you're in downtown Seaside and all of a sudden the sand turns to quicksand, what do you do?
Same instructions. I mean, get to high ground. I mean, it's the when the earthquake quakes, different soil types react differently. Softer soils jiggle like jello, harder basalt soils don't. So we have all kinds of soft and hard soils interspersed throughout the place. So you kind of you can know where there's more or less kind of mushy soils, and those are the places that might get the investment for some structural basement reinforcement.
Now, you mentioned the Dagami maps that are coming out. Are they going to take these kind of considerations in the map?
They do. They're already, I mean, the Dagami maps are out, the evacuation brochures that people are familiar with, the green, brown, and yellow, and they take into consideration the subsidence. They're very well thought through. They're the best maps on the planet for this.
Cool. Now, as far as bridges go, we assume we're going to lose a lot of bridges. Are there bridges that are going to hold up?
So when trying to understand what's going to happen next time, we have to understand that there have been, say, 42 of these events, and they've all been different. So I come back to it's really tough to give a specific answer to a scenario without knowing what earthquake we're talking about. So we will either get an 8 off the south coast or a 9 along the whole expanse of the subduction zone. If it's an 8 on the south coast, we're going to have less earthquake, less subsidence, fewer landslides, and all around better up here on the north coast. If it's a 9 that goes the entire way, well, we're going to get what we got last time, and you're right, it'll be very difficult to travel around.
Well, I think it's important to understand that the difference between 8 and 9 is not just a simple integer, and that is to logarithmic scale. So 9 is actually 10 times more powerful than an 8.
30.
Could you kind of expand on that a bit?
I can. So the Richter scale is what we try to do to give some sense of the relative badness of earthquakes. And it's a scale that's been around since the turn of the century, and it's a convention, but it's not particularly useful because most regular people don't understand this logarithmic kind of math stuff. Mm-hmm. But it basically is, an 8 is 30 times worse than a 7, but a 9 is 30 times 30, 90 times worse than a 7. And so, a 9 being like 30 times worse than an 8, that's a whole lot.
Yeah.
And so I'd much rather have an 8 than a 9. So the point is the next one will occur on a spectrum from what I call bad to ugly. We're equally as likely to get an 8 as we are a 9. An 8 would be bad. A 9 would be ugly. So in an 8 scenario, we'll have a lot more opportunity to execute our plans and do our things. In a 9, there'll be more challenges.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes left, Patrick, and I'm wondering whether you can kind of sum up your message to those of us that live on the subduction zone.
Sure thing. And I'm hearkening back to an article in The New Yorker this summer that got a lot of people's attention.
That's right. I read that one.
And it was very well written. Catherine Schultz is the author, and the story she chose to write got the frequency just right on. What she said was, at 315 years in the cycle, we need to expect this thing. So the urgency she described was accurate. What she then went on to describe, well, what can we expect sort of soon? She went on to describe a magnitude 9, the worst possible scenario. All bridges go down, all landslides go down, all this kind of stuff. So she got the frequency right, but in describing what we can expect, she only described the ugly.
Yeah,
what I'm saying is it's equally likely to have something far less bad. Still bad. I don't want to underplay it. But we will have far more ability to do our good things after an 8 than after a 9. And I just don't want people to go – people have the human nature tendency to toggle from I don't believe this is going to happen to it will be so bad there's nothing I can do. That's not true. This will happen, and Japan and Chile show us there are a number of things we can do to increase our odds. So the likelihood of this happening is more likely than you think, but the scenario is probably less bad than you're imagining, if you can kind of understand. So we got to be ready, but let's not blind ourselves with the potential lights out scenario. Let's take the steps to be prepared for whatever scenario.
Well, I thought that the Schultz article was really a little bit more alarmist than it needed to be.
If you ask the question, could that scenario happen, the answer is yes. Back when Mount Mazama was turning into Crater Lake, for example, a highly tectonic time, that those kind of things happened more frequently. You need to plan with the worst case in mind, without question, but the more likely case is bad enough for us to prepare for. Everything we do to prepare for an 8 will serve us for a 9.
So her article, which was alarmist, but was actually describing kind of a worst-case scenario?
Absolutely. Okay. The worst case. Yeah, so we're more likely to get something, but what we're likely to get next time is probably less bad than the worst that ever happened. It's kind of like storms. We're going to have another storm this winter. That doesn't mean it's going to be just like the 2007 storm. So it's tough trying to answer questions specifically when we don't know what the next earthquake is going to be like. There is that variability we just have to accept.
But we do know that the ground's going to kind of shake.
Oh, yeah. And people say, well, how will you know? And it's the duration. I mean, it's not like, ooh, it starts and it stops, but it keeps on going. So the longer you feel it, the worse it is, and the higher you should go out of the inundation zone.
Yeah. Well, it's been Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and I'm really excited to have spoken with Patrick Corcoran, Patrick used to be a neighbor of mine. He still lives in Astoria, and his job is to describe things that we've just talked about. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks, Terry.
And Terry Wilson, thanks again for a remarkable job of engineering. And I'd like to invite our listeners to stick around to hear Albert Smith's always really wonderful folk show. And until next week, when we'll be visiting with another guest, goodbye.